You know, you guys are amazing to hang in there as long as you have with the book of Revelation. I was talking to a couple of people. Some of you know Bob Turner and Nancy, and I had a nice conversation with them, and they said they just couldn't take that much Revelation. So I know that that's true for several people, but thank you for hanging in there with it. We're about to be kind of at the payoff of the book of Revelation, because it seemed like for the last, we're in chapter 20 tonight, but at least since about chapter 4 forward, there was a lot of imagery about what will ultimately happen to those who are against God. And tonight we'll finish that. And then of course the last 2 weeks will be that very beautiful vision of what the future will be like. So here's where we are. Last week we were in chapter 19, and John narrated the first battle of Armageddon. We'll get the second one tonight. And he talked about the fall of the beast, which we know in Revelation is a reference to Rome. Today in chapter 20, John now turns from the world back to the more cosmic level, the more universal level. And he's going to deal with the cosmic force that is behind the evil that we experience. In John's time, they may experience it through Rome, but the understanding was that behind Rome, there stood a much more deeper and more sinister power, which he referred to as simply the dragon. So today he's going to deal with the dragon. He's going to narrate the final events that must happen before the coming of God's kingdom. And this is going to take us into material that a lot of religious groups mine pretty heavily, the idea of the millennium. Some of you may have heard of the rapture. That's not actually a biblical idea, but some of the material for the rapture we'll be covering. And then the second battle of Armageddon. As always in John, we're going to begin with an angel coming out of heaven, bringing the message. And that's always an indication that something very important is about to happen. We begin chapter 20, verses 1, 2, and 3 with the binding of Satan and with the millennium. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain. He seized the dragon, that ancient serpent, who is the devil, is Satan. Kind of a four-time repetition there. Dragon, serpent, devil, Satan, all for the same entity. And bound him for 1,000 years and threw him into a pit and locked and sealed it over him. Some real finality here. So that he would deceive the nations no more until the 1,000 years were ended. After that, he must be let out. You kind of wonder why, but he must be let out for a little while. Now, this idea of Satan being bound is an image that for many of us, if you're reading scripture, you know, this is kind of a new image that's been introduced to us. But in John's world, the world of the first century, particularly people with a Jewish background, this was not a new image. It was a very familiar one. It's an image that you particularly find in other apocalyptic literature of the period. It first appears in the book of Enoch. So I thought we'd might just sort of show this, you know, John has one version, Enoch has another. Enoch is probably written 200 years or maybe a little bit more before the book of Revelation. Enoch and Daniel are probably the first two apocalypses, both probably written during the Maccabean period. This is what we have in Enoch chapter 10. And again, the Lord said to Raphael, one of the archangels, bind Azazel, in this book, the name of the devil, hand and foot, cast him into the darkness. Place upon him not chains, but rough and jagged rocks, and cover him with darkness, and let him abide there forever, and cover his face so that he may not see any light. And on the day of the great judgment, he shall be cast into the fire. Now, obviously, there's some differences, but the similarities are striking. Enoch and John and some others like 2nd Baruch and 4th Ezra, other sources out there, make the point that Satan is to be bound. Satan is to be cast into darkness, either for a period of time or for eternity. And then ultimately will be tossed into fire. So there seems to be a common tradition that's being drawn on. And really what's going on here is that John and Enoch and the other writings are making the point that Satan and the forces of evil are not omnipotent. They are not all-powerful. And they will not prevail forever, even if at the present moment it appears that evil is winning. Evil is not as invincible as it appears, meaning it can be defeated. And in this chapter, that's what John's going to narrate, the defeat of evil. Ultimately, the power of evil will be contained, it will be eliminated, it will be destroyed. But in the meantime, as John has told us repeatedly, it remains a force that we have to contend with. Now, he uses the image of the pit, which literally is the abyss, abyssus. Literally, that is used in scripture and other places, a bottomless pit. The idea is it's something from which nothing can ever get out because there simply is no bottom to it. But the other point that John wants to make is that there is a reason that Satan is only bound for 1,000 years and then released again. You would think that the whole point is simply to get rid of Satan, therefore just get rid of him. Why this temporary binding? Why would Satan then be released back on the world later? Well, in the book of Revelation, there's a very specific reason for that. And it's not just to delay Satan's ultimate destruction. Earlier in Revelation, there's a lot of language that's sort of delaying language, you know, already but not yet. But here, God has a special purpose for this special time known as the millennium. John now turns to this purpose to narrate it for us in verses 4-6. I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their testimony of Jesus and for the word of God. In other words, the martyrs. They had not worshiped the beast, and they had not worshiped its image. They had not received the mark on their foreheads or on the hands, saying that they had given in to the beast. They now came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. And the rest of the dead did not come back until 1,000 years had ended. This, John says, is the first resurrection. There'll be a second resurrection, but this is the first. And we get another beatitude. There's about 5 of them in the book of Revelation. Blessed and holy are those who share in the first resurrection. Over these, the second death has no power. So first resurrection, second resurrection. First death, second death. For they will be priests of God and of Christ, and they will reign with him 1,000 years. In other words, the millennium is a reward for those who have been faithful and true, those who have not succumbed to pressure, to worship at the altars of Rome and Caesar, and specifically, those who have now paid the ultimate price. In John's language, they have been beheaded, which means they've died, and you know, that would have been in different forms. And for their testimony to Jesus, we know in John thoroughly, testimony or witness is the word that he actually uses that's translated testimony, is the word martyr. So the testimony they give, the witness that they give, is the giving of their lives for the word of God. And they are not alone, and they have this reward. So the first resurrection is for those who've been martyred, and that's a reward for their faithfulness, for their suffering, and for what they've been through. The second resurrection will be 1,000 years later, and it will be for everyone else. So two categories of people, those who've given their all for God, or in one category, And the rest of us are in the second category. And the second category will include the last judgment. Now, John's view is that this last judgment and this final thing at the end of 1,000 years will happen at the very end of time. And just to lay it out there, there are different multiple understandings of timelines in the ancient world. So John's timeline is somewhat different. We're going to have first of all, a defeat of Satan. We're going to have the first resurrection. We're going to have the millennium, where those who have been martyred get special time to be with God, be with Christ. And then Satan will be left out. There's a second battle of Armageddon. There's a second resurrection, and there's a final judgment. That's John's timeline. There are others. Let me just give you one. In 1 Corinthians, Paul clearly is narrating the same sequence of events. He shares this, but his view is different from the one in John. So this is 1 Corinthians 15. Again, that's that famous resurrection chapter. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet, the trumpet will sound, and the dead shall be raised imperishable, and we shall be changed. Now, the traditional Jewish view of what would happen at the end of the age is radically this worldly. For Paul, there's no millennium and only one resurrection. But again, Jewish hope is very this world centered. So it's not expressed in terms of going to heaven. That's not a concept you're going to find in Revelation, and really not in Paul. It's viewed in terms of a physical resurrection of the body here and now. I thought you might like this. In the Life After Death series, we'll look at a whole bunch of examples from this period, but there's one that's particularly graphic. This is from the book of 2 Maccabees. It's written probably a little bit after the Maccabean revolt, but here's the backstory. The Greek Seleucids are persecuting the Jews, trying to stamp out their faith, and they have outlawed Torah, they have outlawed circumcision, they have outlawed everything kosher, everything has to do it. Anybody that's caught violating that will die. And so in this story, and it's kind of a really wild story, a mother has 7 sons, and the 7 sons are tortured to death one after another graphically to surrender, to surrender and give in to the Greek Empire. And in the end, she will be tortured to death. This is the part that deals with the 7th and final son. He's been tortured. He's just about to expire. In his last moment, this is the scene. And when he was at his last breath, he said to the Greeks who are torturing him, "You dismiss us being him and his 6 other brothers, you dismiss us from this present life. But the King of the universe will raise us up to an everlasting and renewal of life." When it was demanded, he quickly put out his tongue, not as a blowing a raspberry thing, courageously stretched forth his hands, because they're cutting them off. They're going to cut his tongue out. They're going to cut his hands off. He just courageously presents them and says this: "I got these from heaven and from God. I hope to get them back again." Very literal, very physical. It's a resurrection of the physical body. It's a resurrection of this body. And the idea is that the God who gave me my first body and all of its parts will give me a new one. Jewish hope was also expressed in terms of a restoration of creation itself. This world that we're a part of will be transformed into a new Eden. And in the next 2 weeks in Revelation 21 and 22, you're going to see this, because that's where John moves in the final act. In this view, and we see it in Revelation, we do not go to heaven. Heaven comes to us. "I saw a new heaven and a new earth, and a new Jerusalem descending," coming to us. So it's here. we see this in the Jewish literature of the period. And here I thought you might like some other examples, because we're going to be getting into this the next 2 weeks. But here's some other examples. Second Baruch is a Jewish apocalypse like Daniel, like Enoch, like Revelation, but Revelation is Christian. This is Jewish. And here we have this. And it shall come to pass when all is accomplished at the end of time, that the Messiah shall begin to be revealed. Then there shall be food for all that are left. The earth also shall yield its fruit 10,000-fold. If any of you've got any kind of farming backgrounds, I mean, it's just off the charts. And get this. And on one vine will be 1,000 branches. And on one branch will produce 1,000 clusters of grapes. And one cluster will produce 1,000 grapes. And one grape will produce 120 gallons of wine. Don't go literal with this. You'll just trip every breaker you've got. This is over-the-top language for the bounty that it will be. And those who have hungered will rejoice. And going to be kind of like a frat party with that much alcohol. As a Jewish Christian, John is also going to express hope for the future in terms that are radically this worldly, not leaving the world, not going off to heaven, but really a full circle 360 back to Genesis chapters 2 and 3, back to the Garden of Eden, back to what God intended. The next 2 weeks we'll be looking at them. Now, many of the early Christian fathers, New Testament is primarily the first century. The early Christian fathers are basically second, third, and fourth century, with the second century being particularly important. This is the generation or two after those who'd known Jesus had died. We're going to look at a couple examples of what they thought. They have the exact same hope. The earliest Christian fathers of the second century consistently picture the hope that we have, the hope that John is talking about, in terms of physical restoration, and in terms of the restoration, not just of us individually, but of all of creation. Here's Irenaeus. He is writing early in the second century, one of the great Christian fathers. He's basically maybe a generation after John, maybe less. For it is only right, this is a logical argument, it is only right that the righteous, God's people, should receive the reward for their endurance, their suffering, their witness, their martyrdoms, and that they should receive it in the created order in which they suffered hardship and affliction. We suffered in this world, we should be rewarded in this world. And that they should be brought to life in that created order in which they were put to death, and to reign where they had endured bondage. No going to heaven here, no second place to go. God's reward will be in the exact same place where all the pain and suffering was fulfilled. Therefore, this created order, the world that you and I live in, must be restored to its first condition. And that would be back to the Garden of Eden and be made subject to the righteous. Tertullian is probably a generation after Irenaeus, still second century, probably mid-second century, very similar kind of thinking. For we also hold that a kingdom has been promised to us, where? On earth. This will last for 1,000 years. So Tertullian is looking at what John's writing in Revelation and saying it's going to be right here, right in our world. We say that this is the city designed by God for the reception of the saints at the first resurrection. Obviously, Tertullian is bouncing off the book of Revelation here, articulating his understanding of Revelation. A sure compensation for the goods we have lost in this age. In Revelation's final chapters, 21 and 22, next week and 2 weeks today, John will further develop this view of our hope, particularly in the last chapter. There will be a new heaven, a new earth, a new Jerusalem that descends to earth, and God will say, "Behold, I make all things new." With that, we're ready for the second battle of Armageddon. And remember, this is going to be just like the first one. It's the non-battle. Basically, it happens in a thousandth of a second, and we're basically just told the aftermath. Verses 7 and 8. When the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations at the four corners of the earth, that's all over the world, Gog and Magog, in order to gather them for battle, getting all of God's enemies together, for they are numerous as the sands of the sea. So even this far in Revelation, lots of enemies of God left. Now, this sort of obscure reference to Gog and Magog, by the way, this is a statue in England, an Episcopal church, Church of England, of Gog. John is again drawing on an image of Jewish tradition, going back to, first of all, to Ezekiel. Mortal, this is what God says to Ezekiel, mortal, set your face towards Gog and the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. Prophesy against him and say, thus says the Lord God, I am against you, O Gog, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. Now, Ezekiel is even drawing on an earlier reference from the book of Genesis, pretty early in the book. The descendants of Japheth are Gomer, Magog, and Madai. Remember in those genealogies in Genesis, it's sort of laying out the real estate and all the different cultures and peoples and how they all relate to each other. And Magog is just listed there. In Genesis, Magog is a city or a kingdom in an unknown location. We don't really know from Genesis where it is. But Gog is its ruler. So it's a city or an empire and its ruler. For John, it's shifted, as John often shifts steps. Gog and Magog are now transformed into nations at the four corners of the earth. No longer is it a nation and a king, but it represents the nations out there. It appears that John identifies the names, or intends the names to represent subject kings and kingdoms who are allied with Rome, which is a topic that John has dealt with multiple times. These are kings, these are kingdoms who serve Rome, who oppress God's people, and who do battle with God and the things of God. John makes reference to these nations and kings over 20 times. Here's just one example, chapter 18. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. So these kings and these nations become symbolic of the forces that are allied with Rome to oppress God's people. Now, a little map here, did a little research. John likely thinks of Magog as being in Asia Minor. You can see the seven churches. You can see Patmos over there in the water. That's where John's writing, the seven churches. We don't know exactly where Magog is, but where I put it is pretty darn close. It may even be a little closer between Sardis and Philadelphia and a little south of that. But it's in the province of the Roman Empire. It's near the seven churches. And this is where many scholars think Magog was located. Magog is actually a reference to a kingdom that existed earlier in time, like Babylon. And so John is likely using Magog, like he did Babylon, an older name, to refer to a newer kingdom and a newer leader. Now, this is where a little history is just amazing. Pliny the Younger was a governor in the same area that we're talking about at roughly the same time. He's a little bit later. John's writing in 90 or 95. The letter that we have that we're going to look at is from the year 117. So same geographic area, a little bit later. The letter of Pliny the Younger to the Emperor Trajan gives us probably the best insight we can possibly get into what it is that John is talking about and referring to when he starts talking about Gog and Magog. Here's a portion of the letter of Pliny to Trajan. Pliny's the new governor of Bithynia, which is about where Magog is on the map, basically the same place. He's encountered a new group of people that he doesn't know much about. They're called Christians, and apparently they are refusing to worship at the Roman altars, and as a result, the sacrifices have fallen. Apparently there's enough Christians that the sacrifices have fallen off, the temples are abandoned, and it looks like nobody is giving reverence to Caesar or to Rome or to the gods. So this is what he does. He's writing the emperor. This is the method I have followed with those who are brought before me as Christians. This is not fiction. This is an actual Roman letter that survives. Those who denied that they were or had been Christians, who then invoked the gods in words dictated by me, offered prayer with incense and wine to your image, O divine Caesar, which I ordered to be brought in for this purpose. It's staged because it's a loyalty test, together with the statues of the gods and moreover cursed Christ. These I thought should be discharged. He goes on to say if they didn't do this, he would give them a second and a third chance. And if after the third chance they persisted in saying they were Christian, he simply killed them. This superstition, he tells the emperor, this Christian thing, has been spreading like the COVID-19 virus, not only into the cities and the towns, but also into the country villages also. It's everywhere. But there is reason to hope, Emperor, that this Christian contagion may be stopped and stamped out. For your temples, which were almost forsaken, are now being frequented. And the holy solemnities, which were long intermittent because people weren't doing it, are being revived. The sacrifices are now being sold everywhere, whereas before, very few could be purchased. It is easy to suppose how great a multitude of men may be amended. In other words, Pliny saying that his tactics are working. If I kill them, if they, you know, will not deny the Christian, or if they will deny it, you know, they get off. What he's telling us is that the altars are refilling by people who are denying their Christian faith and are getting back with the plan. The letter confirms that a ruler of a Roman kingdom, pretty much where Gog and Magog is persecuting Christians and is highly, highly successful at it. Historically, it is most likely that when John refers to Gog or Magog as code for Roman rulers and for the things that Revelation is targeting, which hang into your faith, do not give up, do not worship anything else, it is likely that the Plinys and the Bithynians, not just Pliny himself, but other governors and other forces who are persecuting the church, you know, will face the wrath of God. In other words, the letter gives us an insight into the exact historical thing that John is struggling with. Verses 9 and 10. These armies of the evil that have been gathered, they marched up over the breadth of the earth. They surrounded the camp of the saints in the beloved city. Now, military strategy-wise, if you ever allow yourself to be surrounded and laid siege to, chances of survival are just about zero. The people who lay sieges always win. They've got the water, they've got the food, they've got everything they need. But fire came down from heaven and consumed them. This is the forces around. And the devil, who had deceived them, was thrown into a lake of fire and sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet were. Now, the beast and the dragon, evil incarnate on the earth and evil cosmic, have now both been defeated in the lake of fire. All that remains is the final judgment on those who supported the evil. And it's to this that now John turns, verses 11 through 15. Verses 11 and 12. Then I saw a great white throne, and the one who sat on it. The earth and the heaven fled from his presence, and no place was found for them. This, of course, be the throne of God. And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne. They've all been, this is the second resurrection. They're all up, all before God to be judged. The books, plural, were opened, and another book was opened, the book of life. Now, the scene begins with multiple books being opened. The image is found in several ancient sources, but it seems to be, the thought is, there's a book for you, and there's a book for me, and there's a book for each and every one of us, where God has recorded our lives and recorded that's what we've done. You know, some of the stuff your parents taught you when you were real young, that, you know, somebody's watching you and keeping a record, but a record of what each person has done. To that, John adds the image of another book, a very different kind of book. This is the book of life. This is the book you want to be in. If you're in this book, you live. The book of life is another image familiar to John's audience. It's one found in other Second Temple writings of the period. I'm going to just show you from Enoch. There's one here. Then he said to me, Enoch, look at the tablets of heaven, the heavenly book. Read what is written in them. Understand each element one by one. In other words, pay attention. What's written here is crucially important. So I looked at the tablets of heaven, the heavenly book, read all the writings on them, and came to understand everything. I read that book and all the deeds of humanity and all the children of the flesh upon the earth, everybody's deeds, for all the generations of the world. So everything from all times recorded. Now the beatitude, this time in Enoch, blessed is the man who dies righteous and is upright, against whom no record of oppression has been written, and who received no judgment that day. Another one from Enoch. Those who work evil shall have their names blotted out of the book of life, and fire shall consume them. Same imagery Revelation's working with. Book of Jubilees. If they transgress and work uncleanliness, they will be recorded in the heavenly tablets as adversaries, and they will be destroyed out of the book of life, and they will be recorded in the book of those who will be destroyed. Jubilees 36. They burnt Sodom, and he will do the same to those who are evil. They will not be recorded in the book of life, but in the book of those appointed to destruction. That's Jewish literature from the Second Temple period. Turns out Paul is also familiar with this image. Paul is the only other writer in the New Testament who uses this image, and he uses it in Philippians. Philippians, of course, Philippi is the church, first church he founded in Europe. So Philippians is a fairly early letter. This is what he has to say in chapter 4, verse 3. I ask you also, my loyal companion, help these women in the church there. For they have struggled beside me in the work of the gospel. Their names are in the book of life. John now continues. He's going to develop this image of heavenly books, and we're going to get some more content, even as he turns to the last judgment. Verses 12 and 13. And the dead were judged according to their works, as recorded in the books. And the sea gave up the dead that were in it. Death and Hades, Hades is the abode of the dead, gave up the dead that were in them. And all were judged according to what they had done. Now, theology of Revelation is very different from theology of Paul, theology of Matthew, and some other places. In Revelation, you are judged not by your faith. You know, the just shall live by faith. Well, that's Paul. You're not judged by how you treat others, like Matthew 25, insofar as you've done the least of these.
Yes, I've been watching you.
You don't find any of that in the book of Revelation. We are judged by our works. So that Revelation, John has consistently said that only one thing is important. Remain faithful to God. How do you do that? You do that by not worshiping the beast, his image, worshiping only God. In Revelation, these are our works. Not acts of mercy, not acts of charity, not service to others, not things that we believe. Verses 14 to 15. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death, the lake of fire. And anyone whose name was not found written in the book of life was thrown into the lake of fire. Now, with this, John's long, multi-chapter narration of the final destruction of the forces of evils has now finally come to an end. Everyone and everything that is in opposition to God has now had the same destiny, thrown into the lake of fire. The dragon, the beast, and the false prophet into the lake of fire. All others who oppose God have been slain by the rider of the white horse. They've been thrown into the lake of fire. Death itself, even Hades, a physical place, as the abode of the dead, thrown into the lake of fire. Everything. All humanity has now been judged according to their deeds. And anyone who does not measure up, who worshiped anything other than God, into the lake of fire. The only ones now left who are not in the lake of fire are those who remain faithful to God, which would include two groups, the martyrs in heaven and those left on earth who have consistently refused to worship the beast. The only thing left to narrate, and John's going to take two chapters to narrate it, is the fate of those who have been faithful and true. It is to this that John will spend the last two chapters on. So next week, we'll move into that, the new heaven, the new earth, and the new Jerusalem. But for now,